wish we had time to go on, but we do have time for a few questions. And would anybody like to begin?
Where's the cake? Yes. Yes.
Ian.
Yes, Ian.
No, this lecture was actually going to be called On a Tall Bone Gâteau. Waiting for Gâteau.
Waiting for Gâteau.
Just thank you very much for that.
Excuse me. Yes. Goodbye. Excuse me, Ian.
Thank you for that. That was really, really interesting. I have a question, just a comment on your last point. In some ways, it wouldn't be surprising that Icelandic narrative was part of this larger vernacular narrative tradition, right? I mean, that would make sense.
But yes.
The question I have is what do you think this tells us about audiences? Because what you're suggesting is that the poets, the storytellers, are extraordinarily sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very talented artists, right?
Yes.
Presumably, you don't have artists of that caliber without audiences that can understand them, right? So, would you mind saying something about it?
Well, by the time Snorri is writing, there's a long history of Icelanders participating and being members of the Norwegian court, traveling to Norway and to Denmark and so on, being informants for the writing down of history. Saxo Grammaticus, who writes the history of the Danes in Gesta Danorum in English, in Latin, he talks about the treasures preserved by the Icelanders and mentions an Arnaldus, who is his informant, and the same a Norwegian priest or monk who also writes I think we only have a translation of his work. But anyway, he also talks about his Icelandic informant. And these are people who are, as I was saying yesterday, they're involved in the church and so on, but they are also involved in using their language very very much in literature and in writing. And they are also, so they have this tradition of telling stories and of entertaining each other through the long winter nights by telling stories, oral stories. But they also are reproducing the life at court in their own society, and especially people like Snorri Sturluson and the people he has brought up with, who are consider themselves as the aristocrats of Iceland, who have links to the Norwegian royal family, to the Earls of Orkney. So there would have been around them courts, in a way, or something that resembles court, and where they would have had an audience for this work, and where they would have had also time and resources to spend on this. And and production of romance probably was, as the development of indigenous romance shows us, it was hugely successful and had a lot of impact. But it would probably also worried somebody like Snorri, because he was a proponent of a very highbrow, very intellectually demanding poetry, which was his skaldic poetry. And he would probably have wanted to continue to promote the skalds, but he also would have been capable of, or he and the people around him, of adapting this new, or his tradition, to this new form. And that's why it's so compelling, this fact that he is putting the skald, the representative of the Viking diaspora world of old, he's putting him in the position of the errant knight, though he by this borrowing from Ivar, which can also be not only a borrowing but also an intertextual kind of quote, one could say. But I think that just to go directly to your answer, I think that there is an audience in Iceland. It's small, the authors are probably just part of the highest layer of society, and we see that in accounts of storytelling saga entertainment. Well, that's one of the interesting things, is that the people who tell stories are also the most prominent, not in all cases, but very often, the most prominent members of society. So it's part of being a big man in society is to be able to tell stories. So translating that into the all of this kind of complex and rich environment into the production of an elaborate and sophisticated text such as Ailsa, it's not that difficult to imagine that. Actually, I have a colleague and friend, Gisle Sigurdsson, who was reading The Life of Bill Gates, like 4 or 5 years ago, and he's a great Apple enthusiast and a very good scholar of Old Norse Icelandic literature. He said, yes, this is what Snorri Sturluson, he is the Bill Gates of Icelandic literature. He could gather all these things that were going on around him and put them together, and up he got not the iPad but Ailsaga. And so it's a good idea, actually. Yes.
How exactly would the stories themselves have made their way to Iceland? Was it like, what was the communication?
The translations.
Yeah.
Well, they probably. We have evidence of important people, rich people, commissioning people or having their texts copied for themselves.
Yes, so, but I mean, like the stories. Like, would they have had books that had come from France? Or
Yeah. We have, even in the manuscripts that have been preserved, we see, for example, there's a very good, very interesting manuscript that is preserved in Denmark, but comes from Iceland to Denmark, and it is a French 12th century Psalter, the Psalms of David, in Latin and in French. But the owner scraped away the French and put an Icelandic translation. And so it just shows that manuscripts circulated. And so the manuscripts would have arrived, but probably for example, most of the manuscripts of these translations from Old French are late Icelandic manuscripts from the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th centuries. And but the Icelanders were, obsessive compulsive copyists of manuscripts, and there was not this cultural continuity in Norway. So there are some, like some manuscripts preserved from Norway, but many of them are lost. The best record of the manuscript record, it comes from Iceland, but I think we must assume that manuscripts circulated. People would travel to. We have, it's really incredible when you look at what are called the contemporary sagas, which tell us about the people who are living in Iceland in the end of the 12th, early 13th century. They're constantly traveling to Europe. Most of them because they have attacked or killed a priest, and they have to go all the way to Rome to receive absolution. And but on the way, they will have picked up a few manuscripts.
I'm just curious as to what the attribute they seem to have of being extremely well traveled
yes.
in their world
yes.
to a phenomenal degree, in fact, comparative to other cultures.
Yes.
That how much that contributed to their output of.
Well, I think there's a great. If you ever come to Iceland and stay there a whole winter, you can get really restless and curious about the rest of the world. And I think there's a hunger for to know about the rest of the world. So that's probably one of the reasons. And we can all jump on an airplane, providing we have a credit card that people think is credited. And but today, but then it was very dangerous to leave, and few people could allow themselves to do it. So there was a hunger for news, and they satisfied their need to know the world by these stories. I have a slide here, I think, which is really telling. Oh, I lost it. I'm sorry about that. I thought I had it. And anyway, which is an Icelandic manuscript illustration, which shows a wonderful ship, a beautifully clothed lady, medieval lady, and a knight, and it's obviously a representation of a Mediterranean port. And this was, I mean, we can all buy a trip to Malta or wherever, the French Riviera, but this was their only access to that through these images and the stories that were told. And I think that was very important. Yes?
Yeah, well, maybe you answered the question when I was looking for the gig. I mean, so please forgive me. You were talking about manuscripts circulating, you know, the circulation of manuscripts.
Yes, yes.
And I had two questions related to that.
Yes.
The first thing is, when you showed the translations, it seemed to be very Christian.
Yes.
And could it be within the networks of the church?
Yes.
The monasteries, and would it be also linked to missions?
Mm.
And the second one is, do we have documentation on that?
Mm.
Do we have, for instance, a literal slip of paper saying this manuscript was brought by this person, delivered,
mm-hmm.
or paid, or exchanged?
Mm-hmm. Well, not to my knowledge. The second question I answered, not to my knowledge. But what is really particular, I think, in when we think of what was going on in France, more or less at the same time, where there is a more separation, in a way, between, on the one hand, clerical culture and the other, lay culture, what is really quite clear when we look at the development of literature in Iceland, and probably in Norway also at the same time, is there is so much interaction between the church and the cultural interaction between the church and the lay people, and that the lay people are very much involved in the running of the church, and the connections of the familial connections between the leaders of the church and the leaders of lay society are so strong. And there is a tradition of what Martin Aurel calls le chevalier lettré. He actually mentions Snorri Sturluson as an example in his recent book on that, and so that this distinction is, I don't think that I don't think that it's for missionary purposes. It's not from the church, but I think it's more complex. I think it's the monarchy recognizes the value, the civilized, you know, to speak like Norbert Elias, that the civilizing value of these texts, because they are trying to create a new, try to reinforce the court, reinforce their authority over the sons of the aristocracy, and so. And they're trying to polish their behavior and so on, and these translations are part of that. So in a way, it's a lay mission, but heavily influenced by religion, of course, at the same time.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we'll bring it to a close there then.
Okay.
And thank you, Torgy.
Thank you very much, all of you.